Thanks very much for coming. Some talks are rather neat. They seem to have a definite theme, a beginning, and an end, and you kind of spend the time before the talk kind of filling it all in, as it were. This is just seems like so enormous that there just seems to be more and more. And what's emerged is not necessarily something of that's kind of clear. It's not an attempt to say, give specific definitions, although something of that will be in there. But in a way, Deva Mitra, when he spoke of spoke on Thursday evening about the first of the reminders, the precious of human life, said it was going to be a bit of a ramble. And, well, perhaps I'll say that, first of all, I make no attempt to say anything new. I make no attempt to do that. I'm going to offer it in the spirit, hopefully, of an adana. Yeah? An adana, which means inspired utterance. Yeah? An inspired utterance. It might be more like a ramble. Yeah? Usually inspired utterances are quite short. This is not going to be that short. I'm hoping it's not going to end up a splurge. As I say, I don't promise it'll be short, but I intend to go at it with some energy. Yeah, so I intend to kind of go through it, certainly most of it. And I don't want you to be too concerned, go through it quickly. I don't want you to be too concerned about taking everything in. There's something about it which is the spirit of just letting the words flow around the space, flow around the room. Yeah, sort of, as I say, it's kind of, it's emerging from my sort of own inspiration or reflections. And hopefully it's going to have something of value for you. It certainly does for me. So, what is Tree Ratna Buddhism? Let me get onto it. Welcome to our 2010 Dharma Day celebrations. Yeah? What is Tree Ratna Buddhism? So, the community of practitioners that this centre is part of has been in existence for over 40 years, as many of you know. Since 1997, and especially 2003, it's been going through a period of review, sometimes even critical review. It has been looking back, assessing what went on in the past, and seeing how this has shaped the present. We have, of course, Vajragupta's new book that tells us something of the last 43 years. The title of the book reveals where the process of review has emerged. It is the Tree Ratna story. In February 2010, the Western Buddhist Order became the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order. In May 2010, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order became the Tree Ratna Buddhist Community. From looking back, we've begun to look forward. Forward, that is, with a new name. A new level of self-awareness, perhaps. And therefore, perhaps, a new kind of vision. A reinvigorated vision, or at least a new language of what kind of future we want to create. In April 2009, Vishwapani, who some of you may know from his appearances on BBC Radio, gave a talk on an order gathering entitled Three Jewels Buddhism. Given the subsequent change of name in 2010, it would appear that he might have had some insider information. But I don't believe that to be the case. Vishwapani is keen that Tree Ratna doesn't turn into a label. We don't become the Fwobos, as someone once told me, the FWBO, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, was the Fwobos, as they were celebrating the Buddha Field Festival. Yeah, he's keen that it doesn't just turn into a label, that there is something extremely significant about it as the name for our community. It does, after all, mean something. And what it means gives us a pathway to what our function as a what is our function as a community, what we do, what backdrops and even shapes our dreams, struggles and our freedoms might take. He called for reflection, exploration and articulation of what these terms mean for us as human beings today, so that we can become the awakened human beings of tomorrow. So we have Vajragupta's book, and we have Vishvapani's suggestion regarding Triratna Buddhism. I want to speak today with these in mind. I want to do so not necessarily by talking about what are known as the six distinctive emphases of Triratna Buddhism, although these may emerge. My main wish, and therefore emphasis, is to talk about the jewels themselves. If this is what our approach is, if this is what our name is, then perhaps in looking at them, there will be a chance to exposit something of the vision and transformation that is their value. So, Triratna. Literally, three jewels. Jewels. Well, jewels are precious. They are found, for the most part, in the earth. The consequence of millions of years of time. Possibly billions of years of time. And an uncountable number of conditions. They are the most valuable things in the world, in the universe. They are treasure. Buddhists have three of them. First point. Triratna Buddhism has the three jewels as a central context in which they practice. To the extent that they are Buddhists, practitioners on this path will be exploring what these mean in their lives. To do so is to be in common with every other Buddhist. In seeing Buddhism in these terms, we unite all aspects of Buddhist tradition, and we are united with all in the Buddhist tradition. Whether Tibetan or Thai, Hinayana or Mahayana, Pure Land or Theravada, Zen or Dzogchen. To the extent that someone narrowly defines with a particular form of practice, to the extent that someone narrowly identifies with a particular doctrinal position, they will see less clearly the unity of Buddhism, and less will they be united with all in the Buddhist tradition. So, in Triratna Buddhism, the three jewels are central. Just as when white light shined through the prism of humanity emerges as different beams of coloured light, so when light is shone through these jewels, different coloured lights emerge, whether it is ethics, meditation and wisdom, chanting the name of Amitabha, the koans of Rinzai Zen, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the Maha and Vajrayana. All are refractions through the three jewels. So, the jewels themselves. Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. The Buddha is Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha. All Buddhist schools take the Buddha as the ideal of total emancipation from the bonds of suffering and as the highest in human spiritual development. To quote the Buddha now, just as the mighty ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so too my teaching has but one taste, the taste of freedom. The Buddha could say this because he was, in a sense, the prototype, the archetype. He was free, liberated beyond imagination, and no more to experience dukkha apart from physical pain. Second, there's the Dharma. The raft that carries people to the further shore, to the land of bliss, the land of unending peace and happiness. The Dharma is also the principle of reality itself, ever imminent, inherent in each moment of existence, and yet so often obscured by the fire of impurities, by the veils of ignorance, avarice and aversion. Third, there's the Sangha. Like the Dharma, this is of two kinds. First, there's the Aryan Sangha, the noble community, comprising all those that have to some degree woken up as the Buddha did. in whom spiritual vision has erupted, and they have begun the process of transformation that culminates in Buddhahood itself. Second, the Mahasangha, the total community of practitioners, inspiring, guiding, and befriending, giving us the context of ordinary human fellowship in which to explore the waters of our own spiritual longing. But what about Tri Ratna Buddhism? What about the Tri Ratna jewels? So I'm going to take these jewels and I'm going to explore them in a little bit more detail, if that's the right way of putting it. Firstly, the Buddha. Tri Ratna Buddhism is happy and does to recognize as embodying the principle of human enlightenment all those figures in the tradition. Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Amitabha, Amoghasiddhi, Vajrapani, Manjushri, Prajnaparamita, Padmasambhava, Maitreya, Vairochana, and so on. But that these figures are all seen as forms, aspects, and emphases of the qualities of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni Buddha is at the centre of it all. So who is he? Well, first of all, turning to the earlier part of the tradition, he is the Buddha, the one who is awake, the one who renounced, whilst endowed with the blessings of youth, whilst in the prime of his life, the objects of attachment. He renounced things subject to birth, illness, aging and death, in order to become free of the sorrow that attachment, infatuation and commitment to such objects brings. He is the one whose parents wept at this renunciation, who looked on with tearful faces at his taking up of the samana or wanderer way of life, at his adopting the noble quest toward nibbana, the supreme security from bondage to suffering through that attachment. He is the human being that became an enlightened human being, who learned from the wise of his day, who mastered and exhausted their teaching, and who left that unsatisfied in order to carry on his noble search. The Tri Ratna Buddha is the man who lived as an ascetic, practicing to the utmost the austerities of his day, seeking to break free from the body as the site of dukkha, as the site, the focus for pain. He is the man who, in his commitment to such practices, drew close to death, and in doing, saw their fault, took food, and regained his strength. Then, recollecting a time when young under a rose apple tree, and the simple absorption he experienced, sees that pleasure and joy, born of wholesome mental states, are not to be feared, not to be suppressed, but are the natural consequence of such wholesome action. He needn't fear them arising, because he could let them go. His mind was intent on liberation, not pleasure, on emancipation, not ordinary happiness. In his ragged garments, his body worn from years as a barefoot wanderer, he makes his vow to sit under a tree. The ficus religiosa and awoke, had insight, penetrating vision into the three marks of conditioned existence, dukkha, suffering, anicca, impermanence, and anatta, non-self. Yet the Tri Ratna Buddha is not just the Buddha. He is also the Sugata, the happily gone, the blissfully gone. He is the Tathagata, the epithet most often used in the early scriptures, the one thus come to reality from behind the veils of the poisons, or thus gone, not caught by attachment to objects of sensory experience. The Buddha is Shakyamuni, the silent sage, having silenced craving, hatred, and ignorance. He is an Arahant, a worthy one, worthy of his liberation due to supreme effort, and therefore the respect and reverence that is recounted in the texts. He is the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, continually experiencing the blessings of reality and his liberation in it. He is the Sammasambuddha, the supremely awake, that teaches the Dhamma to the worlds of gods and men. He is the Alokutara, beyond the reach of reason, beyond ordinary knowledge. The Buddha is a supreme conqueror because he has destroyed Mara's forces. He is the most accomplished in awakening because he rediscovered the Dhamma and was not taught it. Or, as Bhante puts it, all human beings are capable of evolving into Buddhas, but one man alone opens the way for the rest of humanity to follow. The Triratna Buddha is all these Buddhas and more. Because he is also the Buddha of the Mahayana. He is an ocean of virtues, virtues that cannot be told because they are all encompassing and without number. He is the Buddha of the Lalita Vistara Sutra, an eternal Buddha, a potential inherent to our own lives. A Buddha that through all his teaching has never uttered a single word. This Buddha removes darkness, bringing light to those so much in need with his cooling rays of compassion. He is a bringer of joy, a bringer of good, a bringer of blessings. The Triratna Buddha is the Buddha of the Diamond Sutra, not to be seen by his form alone. He is Amitabha, infinite in radiance, his compassion inexhaustible. He is a Moggachiti, free from failure, whose fearlessness gives confidence to all. He is Akshobhya, holding up the mirror of reality for us to see ever more clearly. He is Ratnasambhava, revealing to us a world of ever-increasing beauty. He is Virochana, King of space, illuminating all moments and arenas of experience with wisdom and compassion. This Buddha is always pleased to see us, and he shakes with us in our basic sentience. Just as the Triratna Buddha is the Buddha of tradition, so he is the Buddha of new places, of new people, and new times. As such, he is a Buddha of evolution, of the higher evolution. Just as humanity is the highest point in the process of biological evolution, so the Buddha is the pinnacle of the evolution of consciousness. The Triratna Buddha is also the true individual, freed from the negative influence of groups, of tendencies to conformity, of fears of isolation and social fashions, able to be completely himself at all times and in all places. The Buddha is, or was, this term being used in another inappropriate context, the new man, the ideal man, in that he offers us a vision of what it is possible to become in an almost valueless world. A world that seems caught in a debunking culture where ambition is disconnected from ethics, celebrity considered more important than integrity, and where we are increasingly asked to compete rather than cooperate with our fellow brothers and sisters. A place where the din, clatter, and clanging of consumerism can drown out our longing for value and meaning. In such a world, the Buddha, the new man, resides, and he will, as Bhante says in his poem, speak. He will, as the tradition has it, roar his lion's roar. This is our world. And this, therefore, is the Triratna Buddha. What of the Triratna Dharma? Well, Dharma is path, way, or teaching. Also, it is truth or reality. Of the latter, in a sense, there is not a lot one can say. Some think that the closest the Buddha came in describing the content of his observations of reality was Paticca Samuppada, conditioned arising. This being, that becomes. With the arising of this, that arises. This being, this not being, that does not become. With the ceasing of this, that ceases. This observation of the mechanics of phenomena is not for metaphysical speculation. The Buddha was pragmatic. He began his quest as a response to suffering and unsatisfactoriness. He ended his quest with the cessation of unsatisfactoriness, with Nibbana. Even if the later tradition could become fascinated by metaphysics, Triratna Buddhism affirms that the Dharma is something that you do. And what you do is to transform yourself through your own intention, coupled with the forms of action that those intentions take. Triratna Dharma places its steps in the footprints of the historical Buddha's teachings, and it sees the later teachings in the light of these earlier ones. So, in Triratna Buddhism, the whole point is to understand the conditions for unsatisfactoriness and to uproot them. This starts, as Shakyamuni stated, with the mind. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. As the Dhammapada, or Way of Truth, blazes in its opening address, freedom will not come from following a particular set of behaviours or rituals, independent of the mental state in which one does them. So the Triratna Dharma involves, to borrow a term from the scholar Richard Gombrich, the complete ethicization of our lives. No moment of experience is left unperfumed, no seed in our once barren inner landscape left unwatered by investigation through moral discernment, sensitivity and sensibility. The Triratna Dharma is one, therefore, of ethics, of the three trainings of ethics, meditation and wisdom. It is the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, of perfect vision and transformation. Triratna Dharma is the seven factors of awakening, the ancient pathway traversed by men of former days that leads through the forest to an ancient royal city, that of Nibbana. Triratna Dharma is the cycle and spiral of conditionality, the cycle indicating the ceaseless round of acting without awareness, and the spiral, the ever-augmenting series of conditions and experiences that culminate in the knowledge of the destruction of all that imprisons us. Triratna Dharma is also the path of the Bodhisattva, the six perfections of generosity, ethics, energy, patience, forbearance, meditation and wisdom. It is all that brings the wisdom and compassion of the Bodhisattvas, from Avalokiteshvara's outreaching arms to Vajrapani's thrusting diamond thunderbolt. Triratna Dharma is the essential teaching of the Heart Sutra, blazing with release from getting stuck in ideas, whether of samsara or nirvana, of suffering or the end of suffering. Triratna Dharma is the koan of experience, of paradox. It is stories, stories from the life of the historical Buddha to stories of awakened masters, to stories of humans like you and I, blundering along the road of existence, as Shantideva puts it. Triratna Dharma is image. It is metaphor. It is word. It is symbol. It is parable, colour, sound, smell. It is taste. It is touch. It is all forms of sense perception. It is the mutual perfuming of samsara and nirvana. It is chanting the mantra of Amitabha and Moghasiddhi and so on. It is the elixir of life, again from Shantideva. It is the one way, the Ekayana, according to the White Lotus Sutra. It is the Dharma rain, refreshing the plants of our suffering world and allowing them to flower in their own manner, all in awakening. It is even the thunderous silence of Vimalakirti. So Sri Ratna Dharma is Dharma from the whole tradition. It is principle and practice that leads to the experience of an end of unsatisfactoriness, to complete illumination, complete awakening, complete enlightenment. The Dharma as truth. It is rooted in the teachings of the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, yet it is a tree of many fruits through which we can taste but that one taste, the taste of freedom. Like the tree Ratna Buddha, the tree Ratna Dharma is also in lands never before touched by its rain. Yet this is not a barren land. It is a land rich in its own heritage of spiritual endeavour, a land of poetry, music, theatre, myth, art, culture, philosophy and values. Sri Ratna Dharma embraces all these, drawing on what is useful, inspirational, in that quest for freedom. Not only that, the people of these lands are beginning to mix to an extent never before seen in history. To the extent that these aid our path to complete freedom from all limitations, to the extent that these forms are in complete accord with the basic teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, then they are Sri Ratna Dharma. I'm going to quote from Bhante now. This is when he was beginning to teach, just after he'd formed the Young Men's Buddhist Association in Kalimpong. And he's helping them pass their exams, that's what he's doing. One day, when the class was particularly attentive and I was feeling more than usually inspired, I was explaining the last verse of Shelley's The Cloud and discovering in it greater and greater depths of meaning. When I suddenly realised that I was teaching the students Buddhism, it was not that I had forgotten the poem I was supposed to be explaining and had unconsciously slipped into teaching Buddhism instead. In explaining the poem, I was teaching Buddhism. This could only mean that at a certain level of experience, poetry and Buddhism, poetry and Dharma, were the same thing. So, whether a poem by Rumi, a cantata by Bach, a painting by El Greco, a film by Ingmar Bergman, all can be part of Sri Ratna Dharma. Although image and sound are important, the most important means through which we experience Dharma is through concepts, through ideas. In our community of practitioners, then, the Dharma has also been seen in our modern landscape as the path of evolution, the path of the higher evolution, of spiritual and transcendental evolution. I find it interesting to note that almost exactly at the same time that Bhante has this insight regarding the compatibility of poetry and the Dharma, he speaks for the first time of Buddhism as the path of the higher evolution. In other words, he is, in the midst of his own mind, beginning the process of bringing Buddhism to new lands, with new looks, new sounds, new concepts, and to new beings. So, Tri Ratna Sangha. What is Tri Ratna Sangha? Well, it is now a united Sangha in name. It is the Tri Ratna. Wherever you go throughout the world, whenever you encounter a Buddhist centre like this, or people practicing together in this community, where will be the name Tri Ratna? Just as with Buddha and Dharma, so with Sangha. The Tri Ratna Sangha is the Sangha of tradition. It's the Sangha of tradition in that it recognizes spiritual hierarchy. It recognizes the Arya Sangha, that there are some beings that are more developed, further on the path, if you like, and conversely, others less experienced, less committed even, and certainly less realized. In the Tri Ratna Sangha, we seek to mutually benefit each other, giving weight to the confidence we have in those with more experience, the love that we have toward our peers, and the compassion that we have toward those who have, in the traditional phrase, more dust in their eyes. Not that this is a static hierarchy. It changes over time, as we change, and it changes in time, each moment having, as it were, a different mental event, either skillfully intentioned or unskillfully intentioned. The whole idea is not to label as this or that, but to embody a fluid community of practitioners who can recognize spiritual qualities when they appear and aren't afraid of acting on those experiences of recognition, either with receptivity, mutual helpfulness and cooperation, or guidance and inspiration. Our founder is, in a sense, the Buddha. Yet our translator, our teacher, is Sangharakshita. It's a joy and an embarrassment to read material in preparation for a talk such as this and find that Bhante has said it before. But perhaps it's not the fact that he's said it before. As I said at the beginning, I'm not really going to say anything new. It's that he's said it and or written it with far greater depth of understanding, far greater clarity and breadth of knowledge than I can. A joy, because it is a joy to be in contact, even through written material, with someone like this. And an embarrassment, because in honour of his gifts, his four great gifts, as his poem has it, I realise that I could have done so much more. In a sense, I could really say that if you want to understand Tri Ratna Buddhism, read and listen to Sangharakshita. He encourages us to look at him critically, in the best sense of the term, examining his ideas and perspectives and testing them out in our experience. This critical reading is, of course, in line with what the Buddha taught. We are not expected to see him as a guru, as a Buddha, perfect and distant, and perhaps, therefore, somehow unhuman. We are encouraged to be receptive to his ideas and to hammer out these translations on the anvil of our lives, to see him as someone that has greater experience on the path than us and can communicate from that in ways that may indeed open us up to the fruits of the Buddhist path, just as the Buddha did with the five ascetics. My own experience, for the record, put simply, is that whenever I have done what he has, through his translations, counseled me to do, I have become a better man. Sangharakshita has set up the Triratna Sangha to be a Sangha of Buddhists committed to the three jewels. We are simply Buddhists. Anyone has an opportunity to make a formal commitment by becoming a Mitra or friend, or they can become ordained, asking for ordination, embarking upon a period of training, and then becoming ordained. We have one ordination, which, this may strike you as odd, is unusual throughout the Buddhist world. It is an equal ordination for men and women, and lifestyle is seen as secondary to the fundamental commitment toward the three jewels. As the Buddha roars, even prior to his first teaching, wide open are the portals of the deathless. Let those who hear show faith. So the Triratna Sangha is a community of people seeking to show faith, committed to showing faith. Now, there's lots I could say on this theme. There's lots that's been said before. What I want to do is pick up a particular thread of the Triratna Sangha. And I want, in a sense, to turn to wider society, which, let's face it, is the entire humanity. We live in such a world whereby we're so closely in contact with beings far, far away from where we happen to physically be. And in so doing, I'm going to turn to Bhante. In the survey, and in an interesting little chapter, little piece, it's only about a page and a half, that ends his introduction to his survey of Buddhism. It begins with this quotation. He says, "As a teaching aiming at the experience of enlightenment, Buddhism has no direct concern with the collective life of man on the social and political level." I'll repeat that. "As a teaching aiming at the experience of enlightenment, Buddhism has no direct concern with the collective life of man on the social and political level." You could say the main concerns that one finds in the early scriptures are in respect of the Buddha's repudiation of caste, the repudiation of the caste system, and his insistence that what mattered was worth, not birth. What matters is what we do. The second main concern of the Buddha's was in respect of adopting an appropriate livelihood. In other words, therefore, not one involving harming, lying, etc., and gaining one's income in accord with the five precepts. There is a myth, as it were, in the scriptures of the great wheel-turning king. Perhaps historically, this is most associated with the figure of Ashoka, a king whose conversion to Buddhism, after a bloody period of warfare and territorialization, his conversion to Buddhism saw the development of what's termed a rule by righteousness, in which the welfare of the people is central to the responsibility of those governing. Now I'm going to quote from Bhante. It's from that same section. He wrote this. Yet despite the greatness of his achievement, it is doubtful if even Ashoka fully realized the potentialities of the Buddha's teaching as a catalyst of social as well as individual transformation. Those potentialities could be realized perhaps only at the present time, when we confront the same problems as Ashoka did, but on an infinitely vaster scale. When the choice is not between war and peace in a particular part of a particular country, but between the destruction and the continued existence of humanity itself. It is therefore not surprising that, although the Buddha's teaching long ago disappeared from India, to be revived there in our own lifetimes, and although in the rest of Asia, institutional Buddhism has been seriously weakened, in large areas virtually wiped out by more militant creeds, the importance of Buddhism as a spiritual teaching should be more widely recognized than ever at the present time, particularly, perhaps, in the West. Indeed, Buddhism is increasingly seen as holding the key not only to the spiritual development of the individual, but to the creation in the world of that Sangha or spiritual community, the presence of which alone is able to counteract the forces of destruction. You could say that the founding of the Triratna Buddhist community marked his attempt to bring Buddhism to the collective life of man. The Triratna is a vision of Sangha that can influence directly and indirectly the wider world. We are encouraged to meditate together, live together, work together, befriend one another, play together, help one another, inspire one another. Indeed, we must do this to realize what it means to be Sangha. Perhaps we offer a blueprint for a new society, a blueprint for a new world. Perhaps that blueprint looks a little different from what was first envisaged. Perhaps not. But it is a blueprint, and was a blueprint, founded on the three jewels. May the Triratna long be a context that counteracts those forces of destruction, establishes a clear path to the fulfillment of human potential, and works for the benefit of all.